May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Rashid Roy. Mr. Roy's conviction was based in a large part on evidence that was seized after an unlawful arrest made of Mr. Roy that was not based on any facts linking him to any criminal activity. Additionally, the state introduced a vast amount of evidence with respect to Mr. Roy's intoxication the day before the victim's death. This evidence was not only irrelevant, it was highly prejudicial, and it was not inextricably intertwined with any relevant evidence.
Was it objected to?
No, Your Honor, and I will deal with that up front. There was a stipulation prior to trial, and here's how the events went. The state actually filed a motion to introduce evidence of intoxication and drug sales. The state's basis for the drug usage was it was inextricably intertwined. With respect to the sales, they said it was inextricably intertwined, and it goes to motive. After that, they reached a stipulation that the drug use would come in, but not the drug sales. And that was based, obviously, on the defense attorney's understanding of why they wanted to introduce that evidence. However, at trial, it didn't pan out that way. In fact, a significant portion of the transcripts just details his entire day before, and that's where the problem is here. It wasn't just that some evidence got in that shouldn't have been introduced.
But was it a tactical decision by defense counsel?
Your Honor, I'm sure that at the time that it was, with respect to what evidence should come in and what shouldn't, because they obviously did not want evidence of drug sales to come in. However, as I stated, when the trial came about later, it just didn't pan out that way. Now, there was no objection.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. It didn't pan out that way.
Well, they didn't introduce, the evidence was not inextricably intertwined, I guess is what I'm saying, as the state had said that it would be. In fact, if the court were to look at the statement of facts or the transcripts, the significant amount of the evidence is as to the first day. The only thing relevant to that day is the interaction he had with his girlfriend or significant other with the threats to her. And then at the end of the day where he says to his girlfriend, I'm going to kill Mr. Neal. And from that point on is the events dealing with the death. Most of the trial centered on it. He gets up in the morning. He goes downtown. He gets kicked out of a retail store because he's high. He can't stand because he's high. He's slumped in a car because he's high. And none of that had anything to do with the death that occurred later. And in fact, an instruction was given, and I want to clarify something I put in my reply brief. An instruction was given that the jury could not use that as evidence that he was more likely that he did or did not commit the crime. Additionally, they were told they couldn't use it as a defense. And in my reply brief, I erroneously said they were given no direction. In fact, they were given an improper direction under a Getz instruction. They were told that it could be used for motive. Well, that wasn't why it was introduced. And there was no indication that his drug use went to anything related to any sanctioned purpose under the Getz analysis. Now, with respect to the concern as to waiver in this case, because it's a significant amount, the waiver should be excused here. And in Indiana, the court in Oldham versus State did exactly that. There was a stipulation as to evidence coming in that the defendant had used nicknames and had taken photos, you know, portraying himself as a gangster, et cetera. And in that case, the court said, look, this is so fundamentally bad, we don't know why the defense counsel stipulated to this, but this is so bad, we have to do this under plain error, and they reversed. And I would ask the court do that in this case because even though at the time of the stipulation it was believed that the evidence would be inextricably intertwined, the evidence comes through clearly at trial that it was not.
Was there any instruction on lesser included offenses?
That's a good question.
I don't mean to hide the ball. I'm asking that question because could we infer that there was a defensive tactical basis for the compromise between sales and intoxication, despite the fact there was the appropriate, arguably, charge that intoxication is no defense? Would there have been a tactical basis for concluding that if the jury understood that he was intoxicated, perhaps that would reduce it from, in the jury's mind, as a practical matter, common sense, from first degree to second or manslaughter?
Your Honor, I'm sure that could always be a consideration. I'm not sure if that was in this case. What I will say is that he did object at the He did object during the prayer conference to an instruction that it was a defense. That it was not a defense. So there was concern there. He also, in all fairness, was the one who requested the Getz instruction. What appears to have happened in this case was that the parties all had a lot of information about the case, and including the court, everybody kind of forgot what actually got introduced and what didn't. Because, in fact, during the Getz analysis, the Getz instruction to the that the court gave, it addressed drug sales. And the parties in the court all went by their recollection and said, I think some evidence of drug sales came in. And, in fact, my reading of the testimony, it did not come in. There was evidence that there had been a meeting about drugs, but nothing about sales. With respect to the suppression issue, the facts that the police had at the time they arrested Mr. Roy just did not amount to reasonable suspicion or probable cause. The police received an anonymous 911 call early in the morning that there was a possible assault involving a male as the perpetrator and a female. That was the only information police had. No race, no height, no weight, no build, no color of the hair, not whether he fled or if he, where he may have fled. The police drove by on the street and saw a man.
They had a location as well, right?
Yes, a general, yes, they did have a specific location, you're correct. Police were in the location and drove by in what is characterized as a discreetly marked car. It wasn't your regular marked car, but it had a little magnetic decal on the side saying there were police. The officer drove up parallel to the man that he saw, didn't make any effort to talk to him, you know, didn't roll down his window or anything.
What was the time interval?
From the time of the call? It was within seconds, I would say. It was like 30 seconds or so. Was not exactly at the location. The man was not running. He didn't see any suspicious activity. He didn't try to talk to him. The man supposedly put his hand up, turned in the other direction. However, the man saw two clearly marked police cars in front of him and didn't try to run.
When you say put his hand up, it wasn't like he went.
No, to cover his face is what the record says. So either like this or like this. I wasn't there, so I can't tell from the record. But to some degree, he covered his face. And then he turned and he was facing two clearly marked cars. The officers, one officer gets out immediately, summons him. And as that officer testified, the defendant was not free to go from that moment. And then when the defendant supposedly hesitated, again, he didn't try to flee, the officer put his hand on his back. And then two other officers immediately came, cuffed him, and threw him up against the car.
How far was this from the location of the assault?
I can't remember the exact distance. It was close. It was within a block of where it occurred, at least. It could have been, I don't know if it was yards or feet at this point, but it was like 30 to 70 yards, I'm going to say. They can correct me if I'm wrong, from where the actual incident occurred.
Was it a permissible inference that if somebody had been at the site of the assault within that time frame, they could be at this location?
Absolutely, yes. Now, that being said, what I would point out to the court is in Jones versus State, where the police actually had less than what they had, had more than what they had in this case. In Jones, they got this anonymous 911 call late at night that there was a black man with a blue coat standing in front of a specific address. The police got there, they didn't see him. They drove around the block. Within the block, very close to that location, they found a man, black man with a blue coat on. And this court concluded that the subsequent seizure was not based on sufficient grounds. And one of the reasons was because they did not have enough information about the defendant. There was sufficient grounds in this case that a crime had occurred. The problem is there was not sufficient grounds, certainly not probable cause, to arrest him. And even if the police could infer, there's a crime that may have happened here, and he's standing over here, that may be enough for them to approach him and ask him for his name, address, and business abroad, but they did not do that. They immediately arrested him. And this issue was preserved below because the court made it very clear that she was trying to determine if there was probable cause at the moment that he was taken into custody. And the state conceded in their response motion that the minute the police put their hands on him to cuff him, he was arrested. And I think that when Mr. O'Connell was talking about investigatory detention, it was
that before or after the knife was produced? He was cuffed.
Before.
I thought the record showed that they asked him to move somewhere and someone put their hand on his back and kind of escorted him over there, and that the handcuffing occurred later.
Not exactly at that distance. What happened was the officer went to put his hand on his back, started to escort him. Even though the defendant was cooperating, the two officers came and grabbed him and cuffed him, and put him up against the car. So it wasn't a matter of he walked him over the car and then police came over to help.
The ruling was when the officer put his hand on his back to lead him towards the car, that's when he was no longer free to leave.
That's correct. And the officer actually testified that, too, that he wouldn't have been free to leave. And the court goes on to say that, okay, they had the right to encounter him. And then once they encountered him, they had the right to detain him because they saw the blood. And once they saw that, they had probable cause because then they learned there was a body and a knife. And that's just incorrect because the knife was found after the arrest. The blood was never noticed until there were stains noticed, but the arresting officer did not even notice that that was blood until after they were in turnkey. The other officer...
I thought that they saw blood on the knife. No?
There was blood on the knife, but that was after he was arrested. There was...
So your argument is, what did they know before they put their hand on his back?
Exactly. And what the knife was taken after he was arrested. And what happened was, the officer who approached him did not ask him any questions, did not see, oh my gosh, he's got blood on him, and he arrested him. In fact, he took him downtown, so to speak, and still did not know he had blood on him until they were in turnkey. Now, another officer, in the meantime, who had grabbed onto him, found that his hands were slippery, and only then did he realize, look, and find that there was blood. I guess the point there is the blood was not discovered until after he was arrested. And there's not a basis to say in the record that it would have inevitably been discovered had they come up and asked him questions, because they didn't notice it but for touching him or taking him into a building where there was light. Unless the court has any further questions.
Let's explore the inevitable discovery comment for a while. Why do you conclude there is no basis for an inevitable discovery analysis here?
Well, in trying to make myself more clear with respect to the events, the officer who initially approached Mr. Roy, had he done the correct thing, would have asked him his name and address and all that jazz. The state argues that, well, had he done that, he would have seen that he had blood, and that would have been inevitable discovery. And what I'm saying is that's not a basis, excuse me, that's not necessarily true, because that officer, who then took him down to the station, never noticed that it was blood.
Well, what about the finding of the body that was covered in blood nearby, and he's the only person around? Would that not have been information that would have led them, even if they hadn't detained him, even if they hadn't arrested him, cuffed him, pushed him up against the car or whatever? As soon as they found that body and he's the only guy around, based on what they had seen at that point, wouldn't they then have been justified to detain him?
They would not have had probable cause to arrest him. They may have had.
That's why I said detain him.
Yes, they may have had reasonable suspicion at that point.
And because of the nature of the body's condition, wouldn't they have had the opportunity to frisk him before they detained him further or put him in the car to take him back to the station or whatever reasonable steps they may have taken?
And that's assuming that they would have still been able to approach him at that point. If you'll recall, he's walking down the street, and then they find the body after he's been detained. If they had...
And what's the period of time we're talking about, though?
Yeah.
What is the period of time before the hand on the back, the movement toward the car, the two other police officers come on either side of him, grab him, and the discovery of the body? How much time actually elapsed?
All the actions with the defendant occur within seconds. The body, according to the testimony, occurs shortly after he was arrested.
Yeah, well, that's shortly. I don't want to sound like Bill Clinton, but it depends on what you mean by shortly.
Within seconds.
Okay.
However, again, just because there was more evidence of a crime did not necessarily amount to reasonable suspicion or probable cause that he committed the crime. And so to immediately put him in the car and take him down, you know, to the station and lock him up, they still didn't have that.
Well, but that would have been a step before that. If there was reasonable suspicion for the sake of argument after discovering the body, and we're talking about a matter of seconds, they have cars, he does not. It doesn't boggle the imagination to think that they're going to seize him immediately once they discover that body and detain him to determine who he is, why he's there, what's his business abroad.
But there's still no indication that had they done that, they would have found a link, had they done that correctly, that they would have found a link.
Well, they would have searched him and found the knife.
I was going to say, forget the search even. The officer did note that there were stains on his clothing. If they had the additional knowledge that within a half a block away there was a dead person who with blood all around, instead of ignoring those stains, isn't it reasonable to assume that the police would have investigated what those stains were and therefore found out that he had blood on him?
But they, even under these circumstances where they did know that there had been an assault and he saw these stains, he said in his testimony, I didn't recognize them as blood at all.
Officer
Bartolo, the first one that came in contact with him. And so the fact that this officer didn't notice it until he was all the way down in the station indicates that there was a less likelihood that he would have gone to that level. It's not clear, but the point is the fact that they would have found a body did not necessarily amount to, would not have given them probable cause then to arrest him.
And your position is it wouldn't have given rise to a reasonable suspicion that would have allowed them to detain him and pat him down as, in the course of that detention?
They could have detained him. Whether or not they could pat him down, that would be depending on the circumstances at that point versus where they...
Well, the circumstances at that point, as I'm thinking at the moment for the sake of the discussion, they found a dead body surrounded by blood. If you're going to see somebody within a half a block that's wandering around at that hour within a matter of seconds of discovering the body, you're going to ask them the magic questions and you're going to detain them. And given those circumstances, logically and reasonably, you would pat them down before you engaged in a lengthy conversation with them or put them in your police car, right?
Well, they did not, first of all, I don't think they knew that he was dead at that time, but with the court's point is well taken that there was a lot of blood there. But they also had the information in this situation that there was an assault, and that still did not give them the basis to pat him down because he was dangerous.
Well, dead or not, surrounded by blood, right, raises an issue, I think, about perhaps some instrument was used to draw the blood.
And that's very possible.
Okay.
Can I ask two other facts? The time was 5:30 a.m.?
Yes.
And is it accurate that the record shows there was no one else in the area on the street? Nobody but the police and your client?
That's they didn't see anybody else, yes, that's correct.
And the victim?
Right. And just as in Jones, where the defendant was the only one in the area as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. James Kreiner on behalf of the state. Your Honor, I was the trial attorney in this case, and I believe that I can clear up some of the questions Your Honor had with respect to the record and the waiver with respect to drug evidence. The initial reason the state intended to put on evidence...
Would you move the microphone closer to you?
Yes,
Your Honor. Thank you.
The initial reason that the state was requested to permit evidence of drug sales was because there was a gentleman who came to the house, Camille Webster's house, immediately preceding the murder, and who was actually present during the murder or immediately before the murder. His name was Chad Green. And he was there to purchase drugs. And the record during the office conference where it was discussed, Chad Green's name was specifically mentioned, and the defense counsel agreed that evidence regarding drug sales could be brought up with respect to Chad Green. His concern was that the state was going to paint the defendant as a drug dealer and therefore make him less likable to a jury. As it turned out, we could not find Chad Green to testify at trial, so we did not present any evidence of that supposed drug deal that was going to take place at the house, at Camille Webster's house, before the murder. Unfortunately, there was a response to a question of Camille Webster. It was not intended to be a response that he deals drugs. I think what it was, I was questioning her. I asked her how she knew that cocaine was stolen, and she responded that that's what he hustles. And during prep, that was never talked about. She knew that it was cocaine because of the color and the way it looked. And that is why the judge ultimately worded the instruction as she did.
Tell us why any of that's relevant in this case. As I understand it, near the end of the day, this defendant said, I'm going to go kill the victim. And there was a conversation late at night. The victim was killed shortly thereafter. Everything that was introduced about what he did earlier in the day with drugs or being asleep or whatever, what relevance does any of that evidence have to this case?
Yes, Your Honor. There were three instances of supposed drug use brought up. The use of the cough medicine, or syrup as it was called throughout trial, was being consumed by the defendant at the Rainbow store earlier in the afternoon when he and the victim were shopping together with two females. It was at that time that, because of consuming the syrup by the defendant, he became so high that he was passing out in the store, and he had some money that was stolen. There was some testimony that the defendant believed that the victim had something to do with stealing the money. I think Camille Webster indicated that she thought the defendant believed that he stole his money when he was high at the store. The second instance of any drug activity of the defendant was with respect to the cocaine. And based on one of the charges, several of the charges, dealt with the domestic incident between the defendant and Camille Webster immediately preceding the murder, not immediately preceding the murder, but shortly before the murder, before they went to a Mac machine to withdraw $100 from Camille's account. The defendant, he awoke after a short period of time the night before, right before the murder. He discovered that his cocaine was missing, and he assaulted Camille Webster because he believed that she had something to do with its disappearance, which required they go get $100 out of Camille's Mac account and give it to the defendant in exchange for that. And that's provided motive of why he beat her up directly. The third incident was the defendant and the victim smoked what they refer to as a dipper, which is a marijuana cigarette that was dipped in embalming fluid, or some type of cigarette that's dipped in embalming fluid, which after they went to the Mac machine, which is where they met the victim, the three, Camille Webster, the victim, and the defendant, walked to a house on the other side of town. The defendant entered the house to purchase a dipper. He spent about 30 minutes in there, I think was the testimony, while the victim and Camille Webster was the defendant's girlfriend, remained outside. When the defendant left that home after getting the dipper, he noticed or believed that the defendant or the victim was sweet talking, I think was the testimony, his girlfriend, when he came out of that house. The defendant and then the victim walked with Camille Webster back to her house, and they shared this cigarette that was soaked in embalming fluid. the court. So that was the reason it all came in. It would, I don't believe, Your Honor, that I could have told the story and left all of that out. I just don't think it was possible, nor did I think it was all that prejudicial to the defense. And I believe the defense let it come in for strategic reasons.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with the standard. It was not all that prejudicial. What does that mean?
Well, I don't believe that that he was painted as a drug dealer. He was using cough syrup, which is it's legal. Cough syrup is legal that he was using during the day. The cigarette that was dipped in embalming fluid, it's not. I believe there's a difference between smoking a cigarette that's soaked in embalming fluid and somebody who's out on the street dealing heroin. And that was my point, Your Honor, as far as how bad he would look to a jury by that testimony. And in fact, the victim was also smoking the cigarette with embalming fluid on it. And as I was pointing out, I think the defense made a strategic reason to keep that in after they reviewed all of the witness statements, because their defense in this case was not that, their defense in this case was there were some other guys who came upon them and murdered the victim, who was the defendant's friend. Why would the defendant murder his own friend? The defendant's own statement to the police was, I tried to help my friend and wrestle the knife away from them, and that's why I ended up with the knife. And throughout the closing argument of the defense, they did mention their friendship. When referring to the incident where the defendant was passing out because of the cough syrup, they referred to the victim helping his friend.
So you're saying that, number one, the evidence of drug use was relevant to show motive. Secondly, it was necessary to counter the defense, part of which was that this defendant had no motive to kill the victim, when the drug evidence showed that he did. And therefore, whatever prejudice may have resulted from the use of that evidence certainly did not outweigh the probative value of it, so as to constitute either grounds for voiding the stipulation or for finding plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I run through the facts very quickly without all but the last drug reference? And what I mean by that is the state can put on the evidence about what happened during the day and doesn't need to mention that he was passing out from drinking cough syrup. Doesn't have to mention that he thought that his girlfriend or somebody else had stolen some of his drugs and that's why they were going to the ATM machine. It could have simply been he asked his girlfriend, or he had a discussion with his girlfriend about needing money, or that she owed him some money, so they went to the ATM machine, and that at the time shortly before the murder, that they did go to a friend's house, and the defendant went inside to get some drugs, and came out and thought that the victim was sweet-talking his girlfriend. Doesn't that provide, perhaps a little bit oversimplified, but doesn't that provide all that you need to have done? And it only makes one reference to unidentified kinds of drugs that the other two were waiting for it at the end of the day.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. There wasn't a lot of motive in this case besides the fact that the defendant's money was stolen. I think the motive in this case, as we presented it, was a number of things that build up over the day that resulted in his motive to want to kill the victim.
But wait a second. Are you saying that the defendant thought that the victim stole his money? I thought the defendant thought his girlfriend stole the drugs.
No, Your Honor, there were two separate incidents. There was an incident earlier in the day before the murder. The murder occurred at approximately 5 a.m., I believe on the 17th. On the 16th, the defendant and the victim were together approximately noontime on Market Street in Wilmington shopping. The defendant was high on cough syrup. When they're in the store, the testimony was from the girls who ran the store that he was passing out and he had to be kicked out of the store. When the defendant arrives home ultimately with the victim, his money is missing. And he's upset that his money is missing, and he's so upset that his money is missing, he goes, actually makes his way back over towards the Market Street area to find his money. And he actually returned to the store at one point. So he did believe the victim stole his money. The second incident...
Well, why was his girlfriend going to the ATM machine to replace it?
I'm
going to
explain that, Your Honor. Okay. There's a second incident which results in the domestic assault of... the domestic assault of his girlfriend, Camille. After he returned from trying to find his money, he went upstairs into a bedroom and he passed out. And I believe the testimony was he awoke sometime around midnight. And when he awoke at midnight, he learned that his drugs had been stolen. And he went downstairs and he was furious and he accused Camille Webster of stealing his money. And he assaulted her, and he had a knife, and he actually put it up to her neck, and he beat her up. And it was that incident that supported the charges, the assault charges against her.
Okay, I'm with you.
So the reason for the instruction was the state brought it to the court's attention that actually there was an inadvertent reference to him hustling. Which is why the judge instructed the jury as it did with that. And it was the only reference, I believe, with respect to him selling drugs. Dealing now with the issue of the seizure, I think it's very important, Your Honors, you asked a lot of questions about timing in this, and I think it's very important to look at the timing. Because the specific timing and the exact locations are important in this. And what is evident from the record and the testimony of the officers is that at 5:17 a.m., there's a call that comes in. Granted, technically it was not anonymous because the Wilmington Police Department had the capability of taking the number. The dispatcher said that it was a person that didn't identify themselves. And the report is that there's a man standing over top of a woman who is screaming in front of the St. Michael's daycare on 7th and Walnut Street, which the daycare is immediately at the corner. It stretches approximately a quarter to half a city block as it goes back off of Walnut Street. Lieutenant Curtin, who is a supervisor, was in a gray Crown Victoria with decals on the side that said it was a City of Wilmington vehicle. He's the first to respond. He's only three blocks away when he receives the dispatch. His testimony, he arrives somewhere within a minute. And it's only three blocks away, and that's probably about right. When he gets to the block, he notices one person. He notices the defendant who is walking. This is a one-way street. Officer approaches eastbound, which is the one-way direction. The defendant is also walking eastbound on a north side of the sidewalk. Lieutenant Curtin does not immediately...
Where is the victim at this point? Is it the same street? Is it a straight walk down the street from point A to point B?
It's the exact same street, Your Honor. And in fact, the testimony of Lieutenant Curtin was from where he initially observed the defendant and paralleled him, which was on the north side of the street, the body was, he described, 30 to 40 feet away, and it was on the opposite side of the city street in the shadows because it had snowed and there were huge snow banks, and any of the light that was coming off the apartment complex across the street was actually shadowing the body, so it wasn't readily apparent.
All right, so the defendant is the only person in the area who was seen, and he was seen roughly 30 feet away from the body.
And correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Within a minute of the dispatch, and the testimony, the record on this was...
Okay, what I'm waiting for, because, you know, you're giving us a lot of facts, the argument is that there was no admissible evidence that connected this defendant to the crime. A lot of evidence about the crime, but none to connect. Give us your legal argument and response, and then you can fill in the facts that support it.
It's very factual specific, Your Honor, and when Lieutenant Curtin pulls up alongside of
I'm asking you to give us your legal argument, and then that is, why is the evidence, why is there admissible evidence that properly connected Roy to the crime?
The argument is at the outset there was reasonable suspicion to detain the defendant. And at that time, there was certain evidence that was gathered in the form of they noticed he was covered in blood.
No, let's go back. And do you agree that once the hand was put on his back, he wasn't free to leave?
I do, Your Honor.
So what we're talking about is what did they know before they put their hand on his back? My understanding of the record is they had this anonymous tip with no description of anybody, simply a location. And they hadn't even gone to the location, so they didn't even know there was a body at the location. But as they're in the general neighborhood, they see the defendant, who's the only person there. And since he's the only person there, they decide they're going to stop him.
Within a minute of the dispatch, which would have been immediate upon the call, he was the only male in the block, and there was nobody else in the block. But
did the anonymous phone call say it was a male?
He said it was a man standing over top of a woman who was screaming.
But we don't know which one was able to walk away from the phone call.
We do not, Your Honor.
So going back to what they knew before they put the hand on the back, they had the call. And this was the only person in that area.
And the specific unprovoked flight, because Lieutenant Curtin pulled up alongside of him, and he said he was about 12 feet away from him, paralleled him to look at him. The defendant looked over at his car, and the testimony of Lieutenant Curtin was he looked at his car, and he put his hand up to his face like this, turned away from his car, and began walking in the other direction. And it was on that basis that he radioed to the responding officers who, if you watch the video, they were responding right behind him. And
so you're characterizing walking in the opposite direction as flight.
I think it was unprovoked flight, and it was directed towards the officer. So,
and then when, if I understood what the record and what Ms. Walker said, when the defendant got to the other two police cars, though, he wasn't running or anything.
That's where the facts are kind of important. The record is important because Officer Bartolo says he exited his car to ask him some questions. He asked him to approach his car, and the defendant hesitated, which caused Officer Bartolo to think that he was going to flee. So he walked over, closed the distance, and he put his arm on him and began to usher him towards his car.
Right, so then we have the anonymous call. The defendant's the only person in the area. He started walking in the opposite direction. Anything else that adds up to?
I would suggest that it was the time of night. This is not a time of day where these streets are busy. This was a time when there weren't a lot of people out, and the only people that would be out would be those people or this person that would be involved in this assault. And that caused the officers to perform a detention. And it's important to note that the detention begins with Officer Bartolo, and Officers O'Connor and Crawford arrive almost at the same time as Bartolo, though I mean right afterwards. Officers Crawford and Bartolo, I'm sorry, Officers O'Connor and Crawford go over, and Officers O'Connor and Crawford usher him to the car, and Officer O'Connor places his hand on his back and pushes him onto the car so that they can frisk him, and they handcuff him. Officer O'Connor testified that when he placed his hand on him, he realized that he was slippery. And after they cuffed him, he looked at his hand and noticed that there was blood on him. And then he shined his flashlight on the defendant and noticed there was blood on all over the defendant. While Officer O'Connor is moving him to the car, Officer Crawford, who was his partner, is separating the hat from his hand and asks him whether he has any weapons on him, which the defendant responded, yes.
Well, we've kind of blurred two of the issues on this appeal together in what you're talking about now. And one is what happened after the hand on the back, which may support the inevitable discovery argument. But before we get to what happened after that, tell us why it was permissible to do everything they did, after the hand on the back, based on what preceded it.
Officer Crawford, O'Connor testified that they were there for the report of a assault, that he assumed that the person was violent and aggressive, were his words, which is why they patted him down and handcuffed him. As far as timing is concerned, at five, the radio transmissions are the best evidence of what the timing was. And they were played at the suppression hearing, and they were listened to by Lieutenant Curtin, who described to the trial judge exactly what's happening, who's talking. At 5:19, and actually the 5:19 minute, toward closer to 5:20, is when Lieutenant Curtin radios to the responding officers. Essentially, the man in the camouflage coat that's walking up the street. You can hear on the transmission at 5:20, Officer Bartolo radioing in that the situation is under control. You can also hear him say, place your hands on the car, place your hands on the car. Sometime after 5:20, it's characterized as 23 seconds. Officer Harlow radios that there's a body that has been located.
And what was the time of the call again?
5:17 was the dispatch. The call, I don't know what the call time of the actual 911 call, but the testimony in the record is that these calls are handled immediately, and it was a high priority call. And so it would have come out immediately.
You have less than a minute, but before you leave, explain to us, please, the legal theory that justifies the pat-down and the search that ultimately resulted in the seizure of the knife and the discovery of the blood on the defendant's body. The question I believe Justice Holland asked you was what were the facts that led up to the hand on the back and the movement toward the car that justify either a detention or an arrest and a pat-down and the discovery of the knife and the blood?
The detention, Your Honor, was justified by the report of the assault, the time of the
and
day.
You're characterizing it as a detention. You mean a 1902 detention?
I do, Your Honor. A 1902 detention occurred when they placed the hand on his back.
Without any questions being asked?
Without any questions being asked, because he hesitated as if he were going to flee from them. And they placed their hands on his back and escorted him over closer to the police car, because it was a very dark, dimly lit street.
And the reason he was not free to go wasn't because he was arrested then, but because he was simply detained then.
At that point, there was a tension. I believe the trial judge so found as well, that there was a detention.
That's your argument. It wasn't an arrest. It was a detention.
At that point, Your Honor, it was a detention. That's correct. That's the state's argument that at that point.
Okay. When did it become an arrest? Because your comment suggests at some point it did become an arrest.
I think the state conceded and would have to concede that when he's handcuffed and he's on the car, it becomes an arrest. I think we could make an argument to the contrary, but we're not. I think at that point he's handcuffed, he's on the car,
has already been patted down. He's under arrest.
How many seconds transpired between his detention and his arrest?
Literally seconds, Your Honor. Probably five. There wasn't much of a time difference between the time it became a detention and the time it became an arrest. However, importantly, during that detention, Officer O'Connor had his hand on his back, escorting him to the car before he was handcuffed, and his hand felt slippery, and he had blood on his hand as a result of that.
But he didn't know it was blood.
He did not until he actually got the defendant under.
Right. So in terms of using that to justify the arrest, that's not helpful, is it?
It is not.
Okay.
The state would concede that. However, the state would also concede if there was a surveillance video that the trial judge had an opportunity to watch, and as Lieutenant Curtin, Officer Bartolo, and Officer O'Connor and Crawford's cars on the north side of the street, Officer Harlow, who actually arrived immediately behind Crawford and O'Connor's car, pulled on the south side of the street. And her headlights illuminated the victim's body. As the officers are contacting the defendant and engaging in the detention and then subsequent arrest, Officer Harlow and ultimately Lieutenant Curtin are discovering the body, which clearly had obvious cutting wounds and was not breathing, according to the record.
So the specific location in the 911 call was identified, and it was 40 feet from where the defendant was found?
In the call, Your Honor, it was in front of St. Michael's Daycare, which is, as I tried to describe, it's a fairly long building that takes up almost a quarter to a half of a city street. Where the defendant is initially observed by Lieutenant Curtin before any contact is made with him, Lieutenant Curtin testified is, I believe, 30, but I'm sure no more than 40 feet from where the victim was.
Is that also in front of St. Michael's Daycare, although on the other side of the street?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify a couple things. First, with respect to Justice Berger's question as to the facts laid out during the day with respect to the drug usage. Contrary to what the state says, the record indicates that the defendant thought his girlfriend stole the drugs. In fact, at A182, defense counsel asks her, "Let me see if I've got this straight. Mr. Roy doesn't seem to have a problem, at least, that he's verbalized in front of you about Buddha, who's the victim, being responsible for his missing money." She answers, "No, not that night. Mr. Roy doesn't seem to have a problem with Buddha about his missing drugs, because Buddha didn't have anything to do with his missing drugs, right?" And the answer is, he didn't have anything to do with that, no. The motive never comes through in the state's presentation of the evidence. The state may present to this court today what it was trying to establish. However, his being high during the day had nothing to do with whether or not Mr. Neal stole the drugs. There was no indication that he thought it was Mr. Neal who stole the drugs. It was he thought his girlfriend did, which may have established a motive with respect to the assault. And arguably, as Justice Berger pointed out, the story could have been sanitized and limited to that respect as to the assault, and then picked up again at night with respect to the motive for murder. And I would also just like to point out one last thing with respect to the suppression hearing. The state, in its response to the defense counsel's motion, and at A31 says, quote, "Officers Bartolo, O'Connor, and Crawford arrested the defendant once they placed their hands on him and began putting him into handcuffs." So he includes Officer Bartolo there as one of the ones who placed his hands on him, and that there was an arrest and not a detention at that point.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.